WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now is Fran Lebowitz, who is possibly your favorite humorist. Her first book, Metropolitan Life, was a bestseller. Her new book, Of Very Funny Observations, is called Social Studies. At a time when health foods and exercise are sweeping the nation, Lebowitz chooses cigarettes, stress, and Manhattan. By way of introduction, Fran Lebowitz, I'd like to ask you to read a section from your new book, Social Studies.
Hi, thank you. This piece is called To Have and Do Not. Not too long ago, a literary agent, my close acquaintance, negotiated a book deal on behalf of a writer of very successful commercial fiction. The book in question has not yet been written, at all, not one page. On the basis, however, of the reputation of the author and the expertise of the agent, the book to be was sold for the gratifying sum of $1 million. The following week, the same agent sold the same book for the exact same figure to, as they say, the movies. Soon thereafter, I found myself seated at dinner beside the fellow who had purchased the movie rights to the book in question. I smiled at him politely. He smiled back. I broached the subject. "I understand," said I, "that you have purchased a writer of very successful commercial fiction's next book for $1 million. "Yes," he said. "Why don't you write a movie for us?" I explained that my schedule could not at this time accommodate such a task, seeing as how I was up to my ears in oversleeping, unfounded rumors, and superficial friendships. We were silent for a moment. We ate, we drank. I had an idea. "You just bought a writer of very successful commercial fiction's unwritten book for $1 million, right?" His reply was in the affirmative. "Well," I said, "I'll tell you what. My next book is also unwritten, and my unwritten book is exactly the same as a writer of very successful commercial fiction's unwritten book. I know I have an agent, and I'm not supposed to discuss business, but I am willing to sell you my unwritten book for precisely the same price that you paid for a writer of very successful commercial fiction's unwritten book." My dinner companion declined courteously, and then offered me for my unwritten book a sum in six figures. "Call my agent," I replied, and turned to my right. The next morning, I was awakened by a telephone call from said agent, informing me that she had just received and rejected the offer of a sum in six figures for the movie rights to my unwritten book. "I think we can get more," she said. "I'll talk to you later." I mulled this over and called her back. "Look," I said, "last year I earned $4,000 for the things that I wrote. This year I've been offered two sums in six figures for the things that I have not written. Obviously, I've been going about this whole business in the wrong way. Not writing, it turns out, is not only fun, but also would appear enormously profitable. Call the movie fellow and tell him that I have several unwritten books, maybe as many as 20. I lit another cigarette, coughed deeply, and accepted reality. "Well, at least 10 anyway. We'll clean up." We chatted a bit more and I hung up reluctantly, being well aware of how important talking on the telephone was to my newly lucrative career of not writing. I forged ahead, though, and am pleased to be able to report that by careful application and absolute imposition of will, I spent the entire day not writing a single word. That evening, I attended an exhibit of the work of a well-known artist. I inquired as to the prices of the attractively displayed pictures, stalwartly registered only mild surprise, and spent the remainder of the evening filled with an uneasy greed. The next day, immediately upon awakening, I telephoned my agent and announced that I wanted to diversify, become more visual. Not writing was fine for the acquisition of a little capital, but the real money was, it seemed to me, in not painting. No longer was I going to allow myself to be confined to one form. I was now not going to work in two mediums. I spent the next few days in happy contemplation of my impending wealth. While it was true that no actual checks were rolling in, I was not born yesterday and know that these things take time. Inspired by my discovery, I began to look at things in an entirely new light. One weekend, while driving through the countryside, I was struck by the thought that amongst the things that I cultivate, land is not one of them. First thing Monday morning, I called my agent. "Listen," I said, "I know this is a little outside your field, but I would appreciate it if you would contact the Department of Agriculture and notify them that I am presently, and have been for quite some time, not growing any wheat. I know that the acreage in my apartment is small, but let's see what we can get. And while you're at it, why don't you try the welfare department? I don't have a job either. That ought to be worth a few bucks." She said she'd see what she could do and hung up, leaving me to fend for myself. I didn't paint, a piece of cake. I grew no wheat, a snap. I remained unemployed, nothing to it. And as for not writing, well, when it comes to not writing, I'm the real thing, the genuine article, an old pro. Except I must admit when it comes to a deadline. A deadline is really out of my hands. There are others to consider, obligations to be met. In the case of a deadline, I almost invariably falter, and as you can see, this time was no exception. This piece was due, I did it. but as a more observant among you may note, I exercised at least a modicum of restraint. This piece is too short. Much too short. Forgive me, but I needed the money. If you're going to do something, do it halfway. Business is business.
That's an excerpt of Fran Lebowitz's new book, Social Studies, and thanks for reading that, Fran.
Thank you.
Your writing has been very successful after Metropolitan Life, which is on the bestseller list for quite a while. And I know that it changed your life a lot, I'm sure, to have that kind of success and notoriety. Did it change the kinds of things that you're writing about, too, do you think, since... here's what I'm thinking. When you don't have money, you feel one of two ways, usually, about people who do. You either envy them or hate them. And suddenly, when you come into money, as you do like when you have a bestseller, it must really change your self-image a little bit, as well as your relationship to people with money.
Well, I didn't envy or hate them. I thought they were funny. I still think they're funny. I think that money allows people... this has nothing to do with people themselves. People very often think of poor people as being somehow morally superior to rich people. This is, of course, not true at all. It's that the circumstances of their lives don't allow them to be ridiculous. For instance, I tend to write quite a bit about people who have money because they're more entertaining. Obviously, a rice farmer in Cambodia leads such an elemental life that he doesn't have the latitude to develop any entertaining mannerisms. However, if you gave that rice farmer $1 million, chances are, unless you had given it to a saint, he would turn out to be just as funny as anyone else. So that my relationship to, first of all, I would like to take this opportunity to say that I am not rich. I made some money. I got to keep very little of it, and I'm presently broke, so people can like me once again. It annoys me immeasurably to hear how rich I am all the time when I am so broke. But I did make money, and I'm not poor in the way that I was. But I never envied or hated rich people. Mostly, I just thought that I'm interested in manners. I write about manners. And so, obviously, rich people have more manners. And by that, I don't mean better manners in the usual sense, but more mannerisms. They display more entertaining tendencies.
Which part of New York did you grow up in?
I didn't grow up in New York. I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in a town called Morristown.
So you really did have a backyard there and everything?
A backyard, a swing, all that kind of grass. I mean, a lawn is what I mean by grass. A bicycle, that sort of thing. In fact, I had that bicycle until quite recently. I have a bone to pick. We had a transit strike in New York about a year ago. And I brought my old bicycle and my old blue Schwinn. And it was cut in half and taken away from its post in my front of my building by a neighbor. So you can see how popular I am with my neighbors. But yes, I had all those normal small town things.
What was your teenage years like? Were you an alienated outcast or a popular young woman?
I was a popular outcast. I mean, I was president
of
my class.
That's the hippest thing to be, isn't it? A popular outcast?
I was president of my class, but I got expelled from school. And I loathe school. To this day, I loathe any sort of academic environment. I lecture quite frequently at colleges, and I've never at a school where I don't expect in the middle of my lecture for somebody to tap me on the shoulder and tell me I'm late for gym or the principal would like to see me in his office. I hated being a teenager, but this in no way, I realize, makes me unique. I think that in any given high school in America, there are only two people who like high school. One is the captain of the football team. The other one is his girlfriend. Not having been either of these two people, I, like most other people, loathed and in no way enjoyed high school or adolescence, anything adolescence had to offer. I was very happy not to be a teenager.
Seems to me you must like living in Manhattan.
Yes, I prefer to living anyplace else.
You wrote a little bit about your apartment hunt, your recent apartment hunt, and I have a friend who recently moved from Philadelphia to Manhattan. That was about 6 months ago, and she's still looking for an apartment there.
That's not long at all.
Yeah.
No, in fact, I have to move again. This is a very tragic
story.
Oh,
no.
And I've been looking for an apartment for the past 5 months.
How do you do it? I mean, how do you look? Do you really wait for people to die in buildings you're interested
in? Well, hope for people to die. That happens so rarely. As I point out, I have that piece in Social Studies called Diary of a New York Apartment Hunter, and it's day by day. It's very little exaggeration in that particular piece. It's not very abstract. It's a real-life story. I have a friend who lives in a building that I've always wanted to live in. And throughout this piece and throughout my life, I call him every so often to ask if anyone died in his building. No one in that building ever seems to die. When I first realized this, it's quite a large building, and I didn't understand why. It just seemed odds were that sooner or later someone was going to die. When I realized that no one was dying in that building, I made a note to check and see if perhaps high ceilings and decorative moldings prolonged life. And also, I became momentarily chilled at the thought that someone who lived in a worse building than mine might be waiting for me to die. But I was cheered when I realized that no one lived in a worse building than mine, so that was very unlikely to occur. It's an endless, and it's enormous. In the last 2 years, apartment prices in New York have quadrupled. This is due entirely, and I like always take the opportunity to criticize Ed Koch. This is due entirely to Mr. Koch, who has turned New York into a theme park for rich Europeans, thereby making it possible for natives to live there. And I say in the book, and I say this all the time, that I envision myself soon to be working in the hotel of the kitchen, a kitchen hotel, cutting grapefruits into fancy shapes. It's kind of like Acapulco in the 50s.
Can you use your name at all to parlay into an apartment? Like, are people impressed when you're Fran Lebowitz?
It hurts more than anything. If you're looking at co-op, apartment Dubai, a writer is not considered to be a desirable tenant because a writer has what's known as an erratic income, so that while 1 year you might have a bestseller, the next year you might well make 28 cents. So you're never considered a desirable tenant. In fact, I ran into this prejudice against writers when I started dealing with the kind of real estate broker who handled co-op apartments. And they were almost invariably women, and almost invariably women who looked like they were married to David Rockefeller. And they had a very grand presence and were not too delighted to see me. So it's not really an advantage, it's a disadvantage. You know, it's worse to be an actor. I mean, I know it's very frequently publicized in New York when some movie star tries to buy an apartment in New York. And quite a while ago, Barbara Streisand wasn't allowed into several buildings. Liza Minnelli wasn't allowed into several buildings. And really, obviously, I'm not looking in the same sort of building, not being a movie star, but the really desirable buildings in New York don't want, by desirable, I mean that have the nicest apartments, all great apartments, don't want people who have a lot of publicity surrounding them. So Gloria Vanderbilt couldn't get into a certain apartment building in New York. It's anyway, I don't have that.
Nixon was having trouble.
Nixon, well, no one wanted him for a neighbor. I don't run into that kind of trouble because, unfortunately, I can't afford that kind of apartment. But
right.
I'm not the kind of person that, when I apply for the mortgage, the bank is smiling to see me. You know, they would rather you made a salary, you know, every year. It's like your credit card companies turn me down and things like that all the time.
Yeah, at a time when people are really into health food and you know, just getting physically fit and things, Fran, you're really not into that at all. It seems to be a pretty difficult time to be a smoker, and people must really just come down on you a lot. Is it difficult to not be healthy in these times?
I'm quite healthy, actually.
Are you?
There seems to be nothing wrong with me. Smoking is definitely a problem. If any other group of people were as persecuted as smokers, there would be, you know, the ACLU would be in there, you know, defending our rights. I always like to say at the outset, I am not encouraging other people to smoke. I don't care whether other people smoke or not, and I wish they felt the same way about me. I'm not interested in other people's personal habits, and I really don't want them to be interested in mine. I have a piece in social studies called "When Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, Shut Them." And this has entirely to do with smoking in public places. It is un-American to ban smoking in public places. I understand that people are annoyed by and offended by cigarette smoke, and I would be the very last to criticize the annoyed, since most things annoy me. However, that is what public means. Being offended is a natural consequence of leaving one's home. There are many things I don't like, chief among them aftershave lotion, which certainly can't be any better for you to breathe in, and but I don't go around putting up signs and making legislation against it. Airplanes, I mean, just innumerable things where, you know, airplanes strike me as a particularly ridiculous situation because no one could possibly imagine that it's in any significant way healthier to sit 6 inches in front of a smoker rather than 6 inches behind him. By and large, I don't buy the health thing, you know, that my smoking injures someone else's health. You know, standing 4 feet away from someone in a baggage claim area is not going to really injure your health. If you lived in, I suppose, in a cell with someone, then it might. People breathe polluted air. They eat foods impregnated with poisons. Mm. They do all sorts of things. I'm not responsible for these things. And I think it's I'm trying to get people to think of smoking as a sport, which might help. Smoking is a quiet sport, and it's an extremely dangerous sport. Much more dangerous than skiing or race car driving. And people admire skiers and race car drivers very much for their bravery. More smokers die in the act than race car drivers, and I have finally decided that it's just that the average American doesn't know a daredevil when he sees one.
I've gotten a good sense of some of the things that annoy you from reading both of your books, but what are the things that really frighten you?
My really greatest real fear is writing, and nothing is more terrifying to me than writing. Nothing even approaches it, which probably makes me less afraid of, other things.
Writing's really a unique profession that way, because, how many real writers do you know who can't wait to get up in the morning and go to the typewriter and write?
I met one in my life. The only writer I ever met in my life who I considered to be a good writer who said she enjoyed writing was Janet Flanner.
A lot of bad writers enjoy writing.
Yes, amateurs always enjoy things. I mean, I suppose, if you were a coal miner on the weekends for fun, you might enjoy that too, although that is the only profession I consider to be worse.
It's easier once you get started, though, right? No?
Well, occasionally it is. For most people, it seems to be. For me, only occasionally. And perhaps it's not for me because I don't really get started. I eke out a word at a time, and it doesn't seem to be any momentum built up. Perhaps in a novel is something that probably once you get more, into it, you probably build up some kind of momentum, although probably I won't in writing my novel. For me, there seems to be no moment when it becomes easier except when it's finished. That's it.
All that time that you spend not writing, in between those mm-hmm. words or sentences, anyone who walked into the room would think that you were wasting time. Do you have to make sure mm-hmm. you're alone so that people, don't just discredit you or think that you're wasting your time away while pretending mm-hmm. to be at work?
Well, I live alone, and I'm very adamant about living alone, so no one is around to walk in when I'm writing. It's unimaginable to me how people who don't live alone write at all. I once went away with someone for the weekend to something like a 25-room mansion in Southampton that had four stories. I was downstairs. This other person was four stories above me, fast asleep. I couldn't write, and I said, well, of course, who could write with all this distraction here? So that's out of the question for me. The people who are married, who have children and things like that, I don't know how they could possibly do it. I have to be completely alone. And
so that means marriage and children is out of the question?
Out of the question. Even close friendships that would result in living together are out of the question. There are other factors. I'm a very selfish person. I don't want to share things and compromise and be diplomatic and say, no, you take a shower first. Or, I don't care if you ate all the oranges or whatever it is. I'm not a good sharer, but at least I know it about myself and will not end up in divorce court or anything.
It's getting hard to live alone because of prices.
Yes, that is a terrible.
Maybe also because of security. I don't know how things are in Manhattan. Do you have to find a place that you feel secure in to live alone?
Probably outside of a bank vault, there's no really safe place in New York, so I don't waste too much time thinking about safety. And actually, I don't see living with someone, unless they were maybe a giant, with a submachine gun, would be helpful. And I don't think of it in terms of, actually being safe from murderers or pirates or something. I suppose it is more expensive as far as rent goes. Other than that, it probably isn't any more expensive. It certainly wouldn't be a factor in me living with someone. Even when I was quite poor and had no money, I always lived by myself. And I lived in a slum instead of living in a somewhat nicer apartment, sharing it with someone. I'm not the roommate type.
A couple of writers have said to me, who were from like lower middle class Jewish or Italian families, that in backgrounds like that, you weren't supposed to grow up and be a writer. That you were supposed to be a professional, like a lawyer or a dentist or maybe a teacher or something like that. But being an artist or a writer didn't really make sense, and no one really understood what it was you do, because you're not going off to work and helping people or things like that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, my family, which is more, I guess, middle class, they seemed to have no career aspirations for me at all other than academic aspirations.
University teacher? Getting a degree?
Yeah. They wanted me to do very well in school, but they didn't care what I did after. That undoubtedly had to do with me being a girl. I think it was a great advantage to me being a girl because no one ever tried to stop me from being a writer. They just didn't take it seriously. I think that my parents were most disturbed when I was expelled from high school. Disturbed is a very mild word. They were hysterical. They did not want me to be a high school dropout. But they understand about being a writer. Now that they like it, now that I'm successful at it, they never tried to stop me. But I have a piece in my book about my grandmother who didn't try to stop me from being a writer or anything, but never had the slightest inkling as to what it was I did. She was a Hungarian immigrant, and her husband owned a small furniture store that my father later ran. And this was her entire experience with making a living aside from the sweatshop she worked in when she first came to this country. So that my grandmother would do things like say to me, if I would call her up, how's business? Is this a good season for you? Is this your busy time of year? And she imagined that I had something like a Christmas rush or that I would have sales and things like that because she just didn't get being a writer. So I wrote a piece that's in social studies called The Last Laugh, which is a way of explaining to my grandmother what it is that I do for a living. And I try to explain in terms that would be familiar to her. So I say that I started out with a humor pushcart in Delancey Street, selling my comic essays off the pushcart. Eventually, I acquired enough capital to open a small store. But business wasn't that great. And I had to take in a partner. Unfortunately, I found out that he was stealing my lines. So I borrowed money to buy him out. Then I couldn't pay this money back, so I had to borrow money from Shylock named Morris the Thesaurus Pincus. It's hard to say at this hour. Then I couldn't pay him back. So I had to burn down my store and burn up all my comic essays for the insurance money. And I was finally done in by that and the combination of Big Humor chains moving in and Sol's Discount Satire opening up across the street from me. And I say eventually I made a comeback by inventing fast humor, which I sold the stores with first one arch, but they didn't get it, so then two arches. And this was an explanation to my grandmother.
I think that's great.
I first published this piece in Interview Magazine, and I called my grandmother up and asked her if she... I sent it to her, and I don't think she really read English at that level well enough to read it. But I said, well, did you see that I wrote a piece about you? And I published it in an interview, and she said, yeah. She said, but I have to preface this by saying that in New York there are people who would kill to be in an interview. So I said to my grandmother, said, yeah, well, I saw it, but, you know, it's not the first time I was in the paper. And I said, really? When were you in the paper? And it turned out that in, like, 1928, the New York Daily News inquiring photographer had stopped her, you know, in the street in Brooklyn, asked her what she thought of something. And so she was an old hand at being the object of publicity and was not at all impressed by it.
Was the real sign of success to your family your appearance on the Today Show?
Yes, especially my grandmother. It was the only thing that interested my grandmother was me on television, especially because she has a kind of had a kind of a crush on Gene Shalit. So she likes seeing me on TV with Gene Shalit. But the real highlight to my grandmother was I did a United Jewish Appeal telethon on television where I mentioned her name to Bess Meyerson, who I don't, for all Jewish people, Bess Meyerson is quite a heroine. So that, first of all, my grandmother seeing me in the company of such a luminary as Bess Meyerson was very impressive to her. And then hearing her name mentioned on it made her, my grandmother lived in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, which is right on the ocean. There's a boardwalk. And it made my grandmother the absolute empress of the boardwalk of Brighton Beach because her name was on the UJA telethon. So that was the highlight for her. My parents are a bit more contemporary than that. And they're getting kind of a kick out of it. My mother has taken the success of my books as her opportunity to get into show business. My mother's most fervent ambition in life was to be Fred Astaire's dance partner. And it is to this day absolutely intolerable to sit in a room with my mother and watch a Fred Astaire movie because she constantly criticizes Ginger Rogers every 4 minutes, mentioning how much better she would have been at this job. So she's getting my mother. Last time I saw my mother, literally the last time I saw my mother, she was giving an interview to Liz Smith. So she's taken to this quite well.
I must say, when I saw you on the Today Show, I was very impressed that you were wearing, like, you know, jeans and a crew neck sweater. I didn't think you were allowed on the program dressed that informally.
Well, the Today Show never mentioned anything about my clothes. Merv Griffin frequently mentions. I've been on the show three times. Every time I've been on a show, he's criticized my blue jeans. He just can't seem to get over it.
Off the air, on the air?
No, on the air, yes.
Do they have obligatory makeup people to make you look right?
They have makeup on the Merv Griffin Show, but the lights are about 7 zillion watts. So without it, I tend to disappear entirely. It's not what you call... Is it makeup so much to make you look pretty as it is to make you actually...
Appear
at all.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Fran Lebowitz, author of two very popular books, Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. Before we joined them for the 2:30 newscast, I was speaking with Fran Lebowitz, the humorist whose books include Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. We'll have another few minutes to talk before Fran has to leave us this afternoon. A little later on the program, suspense novelist Eric Ambler will be my guest. Fran, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's certainly an unusual day for our conversation. We'll, by the way, again, be rejoining National Public Radio in about 25 minutes. We have a few more minutes before you have to leave, so I'd like to talk a little bit more about your writing. Since so many people have been interested in your writing, I imagine you've gotten a lot of unusual offers, perhaps from Hollywood or television. Have weird things been coming in for you?
I have some unusual offers. I suppose television and movie offers aren't unusual.
The offer itself might not be, but the content surely may be.
I would say pretty much every movie studio tried to buy Metropolitan Life and Social Studies. A number of people have tried to buy both books for...
What would they do with it?
I don't have a clue. You know, they just want to buy it. They're shoppers, you know. They're used to going and buying things, and they buy books. Books that are on bestseller list or books they like to buy. No one had the slightest notion as to what they might do with them. I knew what they would do with them, so I declined the offer. Same thing with television. There's really no difference. Actually, writer makes more money selling to television than to the movies. People imagine the movies because they're more glamorous is to be more lucrative for a writer. But if you sold your book to TV, you would make more money. But I did get some unusual offers. I was offered a syndicated comic strip from a very big syndicate. And this, I actually toyed with this idea because I love to doodle. But when I discovered they didn't want me to draw it, they wanted me to write it, I declined the offer. I received... Quite a number of entertaining offers. The thing is, I always go to these meetings because the meetings amuse me endlessly, and I will go to any meeting with any movie person. And if I ever do write a play, it will be called Meetings, and it will be just a little series of meetings set up on the stage, and you can watch people have the meetings.
Is there any kind of writing thing that you'd like to do if you were given the opportunity for movies or television? Could you do a sitcom, for instance?
I could
imagine what they would do with it after you wrote it.
It's too, it's far too much work for me to do a sitcom. I think that a lot of kind of what are called New York writers who write books and things and aren't millionaires, are very disparaging about television writers, especially comedy writers, and it's a real case of envying them their money. I have a very opposite view, which is that I think that even the ones that make $20,000 a week, and there are television comedy writers who make that amount of money, I think are underpaid. And I would like them to see them make $100,000 a minute for what they have to put up with. They deserve every cent of it.
Can I ask you to read a selection from your high-stress diet and exercise program? And I think this pertains to what we're talking about.
This is, I should preface this by saying that this is a diet that I... developed when I noted that I was always my trimmest under periods of the greatest stress, and this diet allows you to eat whatever you want. All foods are on the diet. The thing is that you have to coordinate with certain exercises. So this is the sample menu and program. And breakfast says you're allowed to have large orange juice, 6 pancakes with butter, syrup, and or jam, 4 slices bacon and or 4 sausage links, coffee with cream and sugar, 11 cigarettes. A, take first bite of pancake. B, call agent. Discover that in order to write a screenplay, you must move to Los Angeles for 3 months and enter into a collaboration with a local writer who has to his credit 16 episodes of The Partridge Family, one unauthorized biography of Ed McMahon, and the novelization of the projected sequel to Missouri Breaks. Excellent for firming jawline.
Great. Well, we're about out of time. Fran, I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you, and
I really
like your writing very much, and I wish we had time to talk some more. Fran Lebowitz has been my guest, and her new book is called Social Studies. It's a collection of some of her humorous essays. Her earlier book is Metropolitan Life, which has been published in paperback. Thanks again for being with us, and good luck with your continued writing.
Thank you very much.